Drones with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hello and welcome. This is episode 136 of the Robots Podcast. I am Jana, and today we will be hearing from Matthew Schroyer, a drone and data journalist based in Urbana, Illinois. But first, as always, let's have a listen to the latest news and developments in robotics with Christine.
Thank you, Jana. Kirobo, a 23-centimeter tall humanoid robot developed in collaboration between Japanese companies Dentsu, Toyota and the University of Tokyo, is on its way to the International Space Station. A mashup of the Japanese word for hope, kibo, and robot, Kirobo is designed to be a companion and communicator for Japanese astronaut Koichi Wakata, who is expected to arrive at the space station later this year. The robot will use facial and voice recognition and natural language processing to speak and to provide information to Wakata. In other news, researchers from the University of Tokyo and the Johannes Kepler University in Linz, Austria, have developed the world's lightest and thinnest organic circuits. Lighter than a feather, these ultra-thin, film-like organic transistor-integrated circuits are just 2 microns thick, just 1/5 of kitchen wrap, and weigh only 3 grams per square meter, 30 times lighter than office paper. They also feature a bend radius of 5 microns, meaning they can be scrunched up into a ball without breaking. Dubbed imperceptible electronics, the organic circuits can be placed on any surface and even worn without restricting the user's movement. Potential future applications range from health monitoring and wearable medical instruments to robotic skin. And finally, Stanford spin-off VBot has developed a robot phlebotomist, a robot able to perform venipuncture to draw blood from your arm with a needle. The VBot system combines robotics with image analysis software, which matches the camera's view with a model of vein anatomy, then selects the right vein in your arm and sticks the needle. A human positions the patient's arm, supervises the venipuncture, and then connects the right tube or IV bag. According to the company's founders, VBot hits the right vein 83% of the time, the same accuracy of humans performing the procedure, but is meant to help reduce the estimated 5 to 8 million needle stick injuries per year caused by human error. For more information on Kirobo or the new thinnest organic circuits, as well as VBot, visit us at robohub.org.
Matthew Schroyer is a communications specialist and drone journalist who has written for various newspapers and websites. He now works on a National Science Foundation grant at the University of Illinois called NLIST. This offers unique entrepreneurial leadership training and professional development for K-12 STEM teachers. In his current role, he also created the Drones for Schools program, which engages high school students with the science and engineering concepts behind unmanned aerial systems. Apart from his day job, Matthew also is co-founder of the Drones for Good project and founder of the Professional Society of Drone Journalists at dronejournalism.org. He spoke to our interviewer Sabine about his various projects that promote the use of drones in data-driven journalism and education.
Hi Matt, welcome to Robots.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Can you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure thing. My name is Matthew Schroyer. I'm a communications specialist, social network analyst, and Drones for Schools robotics outreach with NLIST, which is a 5-year, $5 million National Science Foundation grant to improve STEM education through entrepreneurial leadership. I'm also the founder of dronejournalism.org, the co-founder of dronesforgood.com, and I also write about drone sensors and journalism on my personal website, mentalmunition.com, And occasionally I report and contribute to a small unmanned systems website called suasnews.com.
That is quite a list. Let's jump in with drone journalism. What is the goal and motivation behind this website?
So really, the motivation came in late 2011 when kind of three different movements collided. One was a major world political event in North Africa. Another was an institutional change in the world of journalism and how information is delivered. And the final was a technological disruption. So getting to the first one, the Arab Spring Uprising that occurred in North Africa in 2011 was very important to the journalism community. We lost a member of our community, Tim Hetherington, who was an award-winning documentarian who made the documentary Restrepo, which covered the war in Afghanistan. He died in Libya trying to report on the Arab Spring in a very dangerous situation. And that kind of started a conversation about how to report on this world-changing event in a more safe manner. But getting into the kind of institutional changes in the world of journalism, we're moving right now to an era of post-industrial journalism. And that's the subject of a recent paper by Emily Bell from Columbia, Clay Shirky from NYU, and C.W. Anderson, who's from CUNY. And basically, the premise is this. Newspapers are set up like factories. And if you've seen a picture of a newsroom, it's basically rows and rows of desks with journalists at them. Increasingly, that's not becoming the case. The status of newspapers is as an institution is decreasing, and part of that's because they've thrived on an information monopoly due to their status as kind of gatekeepers for information. But a lot of that has been undermined due to the fact that everyone has a Twitter, a Facebook, a Flickr, Tumblr, and basically 100 other places where they can publish their personal accounts. So the role as a gatekeeper has been diminished a lot, and there's a good and bad that comes with that kind of disruption, but simply put, journalists have to move up the information food chain to provide more exclusive, important information. And increasingly, that means data. So, for instance, Nate Silver is a journalist kind of in this movement. He is a former New York Times blogger for the 538 blog, who kind of broke past the old horse race model for reporting on political campaigns. And he began quite successfully aggregating and weighting the results of polling institutions with excellent results. But probably a better example or more relevant example to this is in drone journalism is the Fukushima disaster of 2011. Earthquake, tsunami, and subsequent nuclear meltdown of a power plant in Japan. The United States government launched unmanned aircraft, more commonly called drones, from an airbase in Guam. These were enormous aircraft, some of the biggest unmanned aircraft that the United States owns, and we used them to collect aerial images of what was happening at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. We were collecting infrared images to find out the condition of the nuclear reactor as it was melting down, kind of the how radiation was being released into the environment. That was great on a governmental level to help track things on the ground, but none of that data actually made it to the people. Citizens were kind of left in the dark about what was actually happening on the ground at Fukushima. In response to that, a group of DIY hobbyists set up Safecast, which was a network of Geiger counters, basically, that a person could build in their garage or their basement, and they were all linked on the internet so that everyone could see the data of the condition of radiation around Japan. And so that kind of brings it to the final piece of the puzzle, which is the maker movement. It's a technological disruption that kind of brings it all together with low-cost robotics components like sensors, microcontrollers, and not just that, but also a whole open-source community to share designs, code, and ideas, which kind of gave birth to this DIY drones movement. So you take all those together, and I created dronejournalism.org as sort of a response to those events. I set it up to help establish the ethical, educational, and technological framework for the emerging field of drone journalism.
You mentioned that journalism is no longer centralized, that it's changing because everyone has their own Twitter account, etc. But it could be that everyone ends up getting their own drone as well. Do you think drones will allow you to keep an edge?
Yeah, so it's really, to get down to it, is an effort to remain relevant. So again, having to go higher up on the information food chain, we know from Fukushima and things in the United States, like the oil spills in the Gulf that came before Fukushima in 2010 with the Deep Horizon oil spill, that there's still a demand for public information and data. And this is one way that we can collect that and give it to the general public.
And you know, the safety aspect is something I had really never thought of. You think about it for the military, but you don't really think about it for journalism. And I think that makes a lot of sense. Is autonomy an important factor in the robots that you want to deploy for journalism?
Absolutely. So autonomy essentially makes it easier for us to do our jobs. Journalists today are tasked with so many responsibilities, not just from interviewing and writing, but increasingly web production, coding. To add drone pilot to the list is a pretty tall order for a lot of people, myself included. I mean, it requires a whole new set of skills. The more autonomous the aircraft are, the less that we actually have to do on the ground to make them work. And there's also an argument that making it more autonomous does make it safer. It's the same kind of argument for self-driving cars, that when you take the human out of the equation, there's less room for errors in judgment and less room for problems. So from both a safety perspective and just an ease of use perspective, autonomy is something that we hope will increase the use of drones in journalism.
Who's involved in dronejournalism.org?
So we are a group of about 50 journalists representing all continents except Antarctica. We don't expect a journalist in Antarctica with a drone anytime soon. That'd be kind of interesting. But they range from a number of backgrounds. Some of them are more technical, involved in STEM fields, who see this as an additional use for their service. On the flip side of the coin, you have journalists who've been operating for many years, some with a technical background, some learning along the way, and see this as an opportunity to augment their reporting. So here in the United States, we have for instance, a television weatherman from Las Vegas who approached his boss at the station because they were pretty much the only major station in Las Vegas that did not have a news helicopter. And this journalist saw it as an opportunity to bring extra coverage. And so the news station sent him to an online university to learn how to build them, fly them, and just understand in general what they're about. And he's been experimenting out in Las Vegas with bringing this into everyday news reporting. And then you have people such as Ian Hanna, who is a journalist and videographer in Canada, who has quite a bit of experience with camera gimbals and kind of the big rigs that used to be, or they are still flown on manned helicopters. But also have experience in war zones and overseas. And Ian Hanna is the operator for avrobotics.ca. They do some amazing aerial video, which is quite dramatic. And so he saw this as an opportunity to apply his technical skills to his field. We also have people like Mike Corcoran in Australia, who worked with the Australian Broadcasting Company and a couple of others. And he's also been to war zones. And saw the opportunity for this to make war zone reporting much safer, among a lot of other opportunities. So it kind of runs the board. And then there's some people involved who are just more familiar with radio controlled hobby aircraft and thought that they could also do something in their community.
That's fascinating. The maker movement has really allowed these journalists to actually sometimes build these aircrafts themselves.
Oh, absolutely. That's the whole reason why I'm involved with this, honestly, is I have to give a lot of credit to the maker movement, and specifically groups such as DIYdrones.com, which is all about homebrew unmanned aircraft. And so for a very small amount of money, and for people who are willing to do a little bit of legwork research and go through some trial and error, you can construct an aircraft in your house, a basement apartment, or wherever, to help you do this reporting for not a lot of money. To put it in kind of real-world comparisons, a news helicopter might cost about $3,000 an hour to operate. Thanks to low-cost sensors, crowdsourced code in the Arduino system, and better battery technology, you can essentially have a drone to own for the same cost of operating that manned helicopter for 1 hour, and you'd have it to keep, and you could get much closer to subjects, especially in the wild and in, you know, reporting on wildlife habitats than you could with a manned helicopter.
Have you personally used drones for journalism?
Well, not really. It's more of in a research phase, but that's partly because of the stiff regulations in the United States, specifically at this point. There is essentially a ban on commercial operations in the United States for unmanned aircraft, and we expect that to continue at least until 2015, if not longer, at which point we hope that the Federal Aviation Administration will come down with rules to help us operate in a commercial capacity. There is some leeway with universities and government organizations. If you're part of a government organization, i.e. a university, you can obtain what's called a certificate of authorization, or a COA, so that you can operate it in a very limited capacity. You have to submit plans for the aircraft. You have to submit information about who's flying it, their kind of credentials, and you have to do this with about 60 days notice. So for things like spot news, it wouldn't be applicable. You wouldn't be able to just show up and fly it. You have to plan it out clear in advance. So that's caused a blockage, if you will, in being able to use this for reporting. But that's not to say there haven't been some very interesting news reports to come out of drones. And honestly, because of these restrictions, some of the most important reporting has come out of that same hobby sphere that developed the technology. Right around the time that I founded dronejournalism.org, there was a hobbyist near Dallas, Texas, who was just basically testing his equipment, which was really nothing more than a radio-controlled aircraft with a digital SLR camera attached. And he was flying this around in Dallas, Texas, and was just taking some pictures to test his equipment, retrieved the aircraft and the photos to find that there was a river in that area that was basically painted red. He gave the photos to the Coast Guard, which then kicked off a federal investigation of exactly what happened, and that investigation revealed that there indeed was a meatpacking plant in the area that was dumping pig's blood into this river. And citizens in the area, in the community, had reported strange smells for some time, but hadn't been able to pinpoint what exactly was causing this. So the meatpacking plant had since been shut down, and the air in the area has cleaned up a little bit, and the residents don't report the same problem as they used to with the smell. So that was a hobbyist who wasn't attempting to be a journalist, didn't set out to do any journalism, but still really provided a great service to the public in retrieving those photos. Some other really interesting things to happen in the world of drone journalism occurred in Istanbul with the demonstrations in Gezi Park. I did an interview for SUASnews.com with an individual who got their hands on a fairly inexpensive helicopter called a quadcopter, manufactured by a company called DJI. And it's basically just an RC helicopter with a camera attachment to it so that you can get aerial videos. And this young man in Istanbul originally set out to make his own personal documentary of a public park, Gezi Park, in Istanbul, before it was supposed to be razed and turned into a commercial shopping center. And in the process of doing that, when he actually got down to the park, there was a lot of demonstrations and clashes between police and protesters. And so he flew his aircraft in the sky, got some pretty dramatic photos of these clashes between police and protesters. Unfortunately, that was actually shot down by police as he was recording. But the very next day, he was able to find another one and continue to fly. And I believe he's flying to this day. And again, this wasn't an individual who set out to be a drone journalist, but after I interviewed him and he considered the value of the footage that he was collecting, he changed his bio on Twitter to drone journalist, and I thought that was pretty interesting.
That's fascinating. Those are wonderful stories that illustrate how useful these drones are for journalism. What are some of the technical challenges that you face in the field? If you really want to deploy these drones easily to do journalism, what are still some of the barriers besides the legal barriers?
Well, we've come a long way in terms of cost. So the cost is not so much of a barrier anymore. It's easier to obtain these high-capacity lithium polymer batteries to get good flight times. The servos are improving in quality, decreasing in price. Really, the thing that's becoming a barrier to a lot of journalists to get involved with this is just the sort of the technical difficulty in learning to fly. But again, I think that could be solved with a little bit more autonomy. So, I mean, the aircraft that I work with are semi-autonomous. I primarily work with fixed wing, which are basically just airplanes as opposed to helicopters. And these are aircraft that I have to take off manually. I have to land manually. It does require some area to land them. And so it does require some technical expertise, some expertise flying to be able to even, you know, get it up into the air and to retrieve it safely. So an improvement in systems and in autonomy will help a lot more journalists get into this. Another thing that would help a lot is looking at the platform not just for impressive aerial video and photos, but as a platform for data. So software to help sort of streamline the process of getting of flying the aircraft in a pattern, obtaining the photos, and then interpreting the photos geospatially, being able to measure things in the photos and know that that's a certain measurement on the ground, would help journalists a lot. So, I mean, this is all stuff that a journalist can do today if they're a little enterprising, and any advancements there would just bring down the barrier so that more could participate.
And on the legal front, the FAA just approved 2 small drones for civilian use in the U.S., so you must be pretty excited about this.
Yeah, it's an interesting development. I do think that it doesn't change a lot of things, because while these certain aircraft might be approved, there's still a whole lot of aircraft out there that have not obtained approval just yet. And even with commercial approval to fly these, it seems like it's very limited. So really, to unleash drone journalism to, you know, to the best extent possible, to get aerial data that's very important for people to have, we need to have not just a number of aircraft that are approved, but basically the entire regulatory structure that says that we can fly under certain conditions, you know, if we meet certain safety criteria.
You mentioned hobbyist drones taking images that ended up being useful, but they initially, that was not their goal. And so that brings up the question of privacy, because all of a sudden these drones are able to take images of places that you wouldn't usually be able to take images of. They're not in the public eye. So what are the ethical considerations that need to be taken to make drone journalism non-invasive?
Yeah, understandably, there's a lot of concern about privacy. I think that some of the privacy is a little overblown, and some of that might be because people may not be familiar with kind of the technical specifications of the aircraft. There's a belief that some of these aircraft, for example, can stay up indefinitely. And while that's possible in the distant future with advances in solar cells and other technologies, that's not something that's going to happen in the near future. And even if aircraft can fly indefinitely at that size, via power source, that doesn't mean they wouldn't be limited by changes in the weather. So these drones are very limited in terms of what they can do in adverse conditions, which means they can't fly indefinitely. Having said that, we do know that there is a potential for abuse here. One of the other reasons why I started dronejournalism.org was to kind of establish an ethical framework for how to use these. And in the future, we hope to include a wiki so that members can actually contribute as a democratic conversation on the subject. But for now, I basically jump-started the conversation by putting a code of ethics online that drone journalists can follow. And it's unlike other codes that I've seen before. This one is actually set up as a hierarchy, almost like Maslow's pyramid, because a lot of codes of ethics are basically just lists of commandments. And what journalists really need is, when working with this technology, a checklist of things that they can go through from top to bottom so that they can, in an organized fashion, consider all kind of ethical ramifications that they may be doing. And so a big part of that is first asking, is there a safer way to do this? Is there a safer way that I can get the video or the images? Is this even newsworthy enough? You know, recording Kim Kardashian's next wedding from a drone is not, I don't think, considered high journalism or something that necessarily increases knowledge of important things among a democratic society. So these are all considerations that journalists should keep in mind when using their aircraft. And as a part of that code, we insist that journalists try to keep all this in public spaces. So we're not interested in going over people's yards, for instance, and seeing what's happening back there. There's probably not anything worthwhile in a journalistic sense anyway going on back there. We're concerned about the stream getting polluted. We're concerned about the oil spill affecting the beach or the effect of the hurricane, you know, blowing over a community or, you know, tornadoes, which is in our backyard. So the code is to try to come to understanding about proper use of the aircraft. Also, in the context of our group, it helps insulate us from from kind of liability, almost, in the sense that if we operate in a responsible fashion, that helps us in the event of someone on the outside participating in something that's not ethical and potentially grounding all of us. So it's a little bit of self-policing there too.
So you're one of the co-founders of Drones for Good. What's the idea behind this project?
Yes, so I'm a co-founder of DronesForGood.com, together with Alexander Hayes, who is a PhD candidate at the University of Wollongong, Department of Informatics. He's worked for Australian National Data Service, a number of other organizations. He's an expert in wearable technologies, surveillance, and privacy. Contacted me after seeing the things that I was trying to accomplish with STEM education and journalism, and thought that together we couldn't combine our expertise to offer kind of a global transdisciplinary research consultancy. So, I mean, part of this is finding, you know, more uses for drones that are, you know, beneficial in a research context, a STEM education context. So we try to work with organizations who may or may not be aware of the benefits of an unmanned technology to their application. We try to find them, equip them with systems that can handle their particular research goals in a cost-effective manner. But a big component of what we actually do is informing the public about the technology. So that includes public speaking. And recently we had a conference in Toronto at Ryerson University in downtown Toronto called UAVs Pros Cons, where we could bring in experts from privacy, surveillance, and, you know, from the technical side of unmanned aircraft to address the legitimate concerns that people have about policing and privacy and surveillance, but also demystify the technology a little bit and start some constructive dialogue about how they could be used and kind of the appropriate limits for this technology.
Are you able to shift the opinion?
Well, we think it's starting to change, but I mean, journalists have been part of the problem. So my group is partially responsible for this, in the sense that most people, when they were introduced to the technology, were introduced to it in, you know, news reports of horrible things happening in war zones. And, you know, that's a truth that no one can get around, because that's how the technology was actually used. But going back to the beginning of the development of these technologies, even way back to Nikola Tesla, I mean, clearly there was intentions for peaceful uses out there. And so it's a matter of finding the public and just having an earnest conversation about how they're going to be used in the future. I mean, if you look at a pie chart of kind of where the funding is going to come from in the future in the commercial sector, where we expect drones to to exist, a huge chunk of that pie, about 2.2 billion by 2017 in the United States, is going to be agriculture. So to use the words of Chris Anderson of 3D Robotics, who was at recently at a San Francisco conference for the first ever small unmanned systems exposition for small business, he mentioned, in the future, we hope that the image of the drone as a weapon will be replaced by the image of the drone as a farm implement. And really, that's going to be one of the biggest uses is in agriculture. And I think there's a lot of people who would agree that that's a worthwhile use for them. They can collect images about plant health, so we know with better accuracy, you know, which areas need a pesticide or irrigation, so that there doesn't have to be as much indiscriminate dumping of water and chemicals. And actually, a third of the rice fields in Japan at this time are actually being tended to by unmanned aircraft and spraying the rice fields, and it reduces the amount of pesticides on the field by being so close to the plant and being able to apply it in specific areas. So it's when you talk to people about this, you know, if they like science, if they like better agriculture, it starts to change the perception a little bit.
And whether it's 3D robotics or drone adventures or conservation drones, there are really a lot of efforts right now to show the positive side of drones, drone technology.
Yeah, I mean, it's wonderful to see all the initiatives that have cropped up all over the world, really. I mean, this isn't an innovation that's U.S. exclusive. And part of that's because of the regulatory structure in the United States. There's more freedom in Australia and Canada and the U.K., you see a lot more initiatives cropping up. I especially like the conservation drones going out into remote areas and helping people who tend to the forests learn how to use the aircraft themselves. So they have their own outreach component that's essential. I believe some people are also involved in reducing rhino poaching, for instance, which is another excellent application. But I mean, this stuff is coming at a breakneck pace, and it's almost difficult to keep track of these innovations on a day-to-day basis.
You mentioned STEM quite a lot, and you've been using drones in the classroom. Tell us about your role at NLIST. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah. So I mean, it's an acronym. So I guess there's a couple ways to say it. But the acronym stands for Entrepreneurial Leadership in STEM Teaching and Learning. Kind of a tongue twister. But we are a $5 million 5-year National Science Foundation grant. We are in our fifth year, and we're all about improving the opportunities for innovation in STEM education. And it's well known that we have a leaky STEM pipeline. In terms of teaching children and having them go on to STEM fields. We're trying to address that in various ways on a national scale with things like the Next Generation Science Standards, which are attempting to introduce engineering education from K-12, which is something that has never been done before. Personally, at the grant, we try to train teachers to look for opportunities with other teachers, with organizations in their communities, YMCAs, Boys and Girls Clubs, companies, plants, businesses, and, you know, at the university level, seeking out professors and grad students and undergrads who can bring lessons into the classroom and start collaborations that have this potential to really improve and reform STEM education. So we've trained about 180 teachers, I believe, over the past 5 years. They've gone on to do more than 32 initiatives. That it's also hard to keep track of 182 teachers because they tend to be so active with developing these things, but they kind of range the full gamut from smaller initiatives to having high school students come in and teach elementary students about science concepts and serving sort of as science mentors, to larger projects like starting up biodiesel plants, participating in the Lexus Eco Challenge. And the one that I'm most involved with is the Drones for Schools program, which parlays some of the experience that I've had building the aircraft in a journalism sense, but bringing it into a STEM concept into the classroom to teach students all about, from the basic stuff of, you know, circuits and battery chemistry, the physics of the aircraft, but also having them, most importantly, take on the role of engineers, which is actually a big chunk of the next generation science standards. It's not just are they, you know, applying equations, it's are they assuming the role of engineers so that they then know what an engineer actually does. And so that's done at the high school level. They design, build, construct an unmanned aircraft to produce an aerial survey of an area. So it's basically like Google Maps, but in real time at a much higher resolution. So the maps that you get in Google Maps, from the satellite view at least, are about 30 centimeters per pixel. But when you get this close with this aircraft, you can actually get 3, 2, and 1 centimeters per pixel in terms of ground sample resolution. So much bigger improvement. The other part of the challenge is finding people in the community who could make use of that. There's a lot of farmers in the middle of Illinois, so that's an obvious one. But there's also opportunities in wildlife conservation, geology, that sort of thing.
That must be so exciting. I find it crazy that something that was very novel during my PhD is being taught in high school classes, and they're able to go ahead and fly these drones. One thing I had, which is going to sound silly, but I had a pink drone. They made it specifically for me. and I wonder if there's anything you can do to make drones more appealing to young girls, because that's not obvious.
Sure. You know, and we have a couple of girls who are involved in the Drones for Schools, and they tend to be very, very go-getterish. I mean, they definitely take to it. They're some of the most motivated out of the students that we have, and that is awesome. I mean, I started out in 2003 as an undergraduate in engineering, and I ended up somehow with a master's in journalism. So I'm kind of right now at the middle. It's some sort of kind of middle space. I go into the classrooms. I help deliver STEM education. I'm not an expert on the research on getting more women and minorities into STEM education, but I do know from experience that there's probably some things we could do better to help reach out and to attract women and minorities. So when I was recently in San Francisco for this unmanned systems conference for small businesses, there was a news report on the television about a program that was basically girls only. So this was actively trying to find just girls to bring in and to have them build robots, program them, work through problems with the robots. And some of the comments were just really enlightening. And these were children in middle school. And some of the comments that came out was that sometimes it can be difficult to operate in the same environment as boys at that age because they tend to be really pushy. The boys want to take a more authoritative role. They want to take command, and that can ruin the experience for a lot of people. And so part of the solution might be just creating programs that cater just to women and minorities. And so I think improving the environment can go a long way to increasing women and minorities in STEM education and in STEM fields.
That's interesting insight. Just a final word on the development of drones in the near future, and we'll end on that.
Well, I think that we've just hit the tip of the iceberg in terms of unmanned aircraft, and we're constantly finding more and better uses. I mean, just the other day, I was reading a story about development on an unmanned aircraft to deliver water during a wildfire, which is something that's becoming an increasing problem in the West. These massive wildfires that stem from global climate change and just general dry conditions. And we actually lose C-130 Hercules aircrafts at a pretty alarming rate who are trying to fight these fires from above. And this seemed kind of like a no-brainer. And I think we're going to have more of these no-brainers as time goes on, as unmanned aircraft become not just more capable in terms of sensors and cost and flight duration and this kind of thing, but also in their acceptance, so that we can open up the regulatory framework a little bit to let small businesses fill these niche roles. And I don't think any of us really know what it's going to be like in the future, but we have some clues as to they're going to be more autonomous, they're going to be more capable. And I don't think anyone really thought that the so-called robot invasion would happen quite like this, but I really think that more than any other unmanned technology, unmanned aircraft, I think, have perhaps one of the biggest footprints in terms of impact in the near future.
Thanks, Matt, for being here with us on Robots.
No problem. It was a pleasure.
And that's it for today. As usual, you can find extra information and links to all of Matthew's projects on our website at robotspodcast.com. The next episode will air in 2 weeks' time. Until then, goodbye. Drones with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.